Welcome to Season 2 of the Triple Existential Podcast. I'm your host, Ebi Cote-Nord.
The pool. I stare at the other end of the pool and lean back on the wall, propping my elbows on the ledge behind me. Just not getting it today. Just not. I can't focus. I sink back under the surface, kick off the wall, and attempt another lap. I close my eyes and move my arms under the water, trying to feel it, to really feel it, to feel the water flowing over my limbs, around them, through my fingers, to feel it separating around my forearms, pulling back together behind my triceps. Focus. Focus on the water. Focus on your body. Focus. I'm trying to remember to think about my arms, to think about my elbow, propelling myself across the water, trying to push the water underneath me, trying to get it to push back against me so I can push harder against it. I lack upper body strength, but if I don't work hard against the water and convince it to resist me, I will never build the muscles I need to get good at this. I won't get faster or stronger if I allow my mind to wander, but it does. I have one goal today, to swim in a mile and a half and to think about what I need to do it well. My hands plunge and pull, trying to find still water beneath me to push out of the way. I try to think of it as climbing across the water. I try to think about the water. I try to think about my strength. To think about the position of my arms. My hands are tight. I loosen them to let them comb the water. Why do I hum as I exhale? Is that normal? One, two, three, breathe. One, two, three, breathe. Can I exhale without humming into the water? What if I stop counting my strokes? Will I ever remember to breathe if I stop counting my strokes? One, two, three, breathe. One, two, three, breathe. There has to be a metaphor in here. What is the metaphor? One, two, three, breathe. One, two, three, breathe. Why am I humming? I reach the wall and stand up, check my watch. Two laps. That was only two laps. And I didn't even think about my arms. I have to think about my arms. I forgot to think about my arms. I'm so frustrated. I look around the room, the ceiling tens of feet above me, the skylight letting the morning sun beam one blinding square down into my lane. It's quiet. I'm the only one here. It's strange that after 6 months of pandemic isolation, the refuge I seek is even more isolation, but my kids aren't here. My phone isn't in my hand. There's no TV here. It's so still. The water is still. The air is still. The sound is still, and it echoes through the rafters and the brick walls. The chlorine kills the virus, they tell us, so it's the only place I can go that isn't home and I don't have to cover my face. A year ago, I couldn't swim, but I filed for divorce in the fall. And by Christmas, I had a restraining order against my husband, and I decided I was going to complete 3 triathlons by the end of the summer. 3 triathlon distances in one weekend. And if I was going to do that, I was going to need to learn how to swim. I signed up for all 3 races and enrolled in swim lessons. Sure, I was afraid to swim. I was afraid of the water. I was also afraid of being divorced. I was also afraid of my husband and recognized that life is really just a series of doing things I'm scared of doing and trusting that I will get to the other side. I always have. I always will. Except for the one time that it kills me, and when that happens, I won't even know. So I might as well learn to swim and complete 3 triathlons in one weekend, because if I'm going to learn how to swim, I'm going to fucking swim several miles in Lake Michigan and have someone give me a medal for it. I'm going to learn how to swim while preparing to run 3 triathlons, which I'm going to train for as a single mom who just had her ex legally prohibited from even trying to help with the children. Ambitious? Yes, absolutely. Impossible? No, not at all. I needed a challenge, and so I gave myself one. Today, the challenge is to focus. But I'm tired. My arms are tired. My mind is tired. My emotions are just tired. I don't have work anymore. I can't see clients. It's too dangerous. I don't have money anymore. I don't go anywhere. I don't see anyone except my family, who I see too much. My mind can't focus on anything, and it's always searching for something to focus on. I'm desperate to grasp onto a single thought that I can hold on to for a few minutes. For months, any thought that I've had has been interrupted by mom, 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 mom. I feel like I'm never actually doing anything, and simultaneously, I feel like I don't have time to do anything. Pandemic paradox. Nothing to do. No time to do it. While feeling trapped inside of eternity, my thoughts drift in the water, the only place calm and still enough to give my thoughts the break they need to focus on one thing. And the one thing I want to focus on today is my body becoming stronger. But I can't. I can't figure out if I'm tired. I'm not sore. I'm just not able to think about my body. I stop at the deep end and stare at the clock. I look at my watch. I check my laps. I check the time. I scan my body and I feel nothing. My mind doesn't register my time or my distance or my heart rate. I'm looking around me as if just noticing a clock on the wall or a watch on my wrist or a body in the water is enough to tell me what I'm doing wrong. I blink back tears of frustration. I can do this. I can focus on my body. I push up and think about my arms. I think about my arms, and all I can think about is how much I wish I could use my hands to claw an epiphany out of the water. I want to feel something. I feel empty. I want to focus. I'm yearning for an epiphany. I want to get to the end of this swim so I can just make this end. But at the end is a return to the endlessness of the pandemic. I know I can push through this, whatever it is. The silence of my ambition when I question its ambivalence. But it's not ambivalent. I'm still going. So I suppose ambition is still there. I don't have a desire to give up. I don't want to stop. I want to keep going. I just don't know why. I don't know a reason. I just have the water. Everything's so quiet in the water, but the water is louder than the air around it in the room. But the room is quieter than my home. I hate the quiet, but I need a break from the noise. I want some time alone with my mind, but my mind doesn't seem to want to have much to do with me today. I flip against the wall and push off. And glide. I think about my shoulders. I think about streamlining my body. I think about how I can't think. I think about how my mind is treating me like my body is floating and my body is acting like it's an automatic swim device moving without anyone supervising it. No one is working the controls. I don't know if it's efficient or on track or doing anything that it's supposed to. It's just running alone in a room away from the world. Maybe I don't need a goal today. Maybe that's okay. I listen to the splashing of my body and watch the pool move under me as I pass through it. I wonder why I always think of Jeff Buckley's Hallelujah. Except I do know. It's what I think after I count. One, two, three, breathe. It goes like this, the fourth, the fifth, the minor fall, the major lift. And how that's all true about my body in the moment. It also serves as a convenient segue to distractions. My mind wanders through the lyrics and messages about love and how the only thing we learn from love is how to shoot somebody who outdrew us. I still don't know what lap I'm on. I still don't know where my elbow is. I knew where my elbow was several years ago in Al's apartment. He was drunk and teaching me about music I already knew and understood and didn't find interesting. My elbow was under my head, which propped up my hand to stay awake in his bed. He has the most comfortable California king bed with the most luxurious pillows I've ever felt.
I've asked him what brand they are, but he's never sober enough to do anything but look at the pillow and forget the question, then tell me how great the pillows are. So when he teaches me about the music he listened to when he was young, it's especially difficult to stay awake. He's 9 months older than me. It was the same music I listened to. And I went to college for music, I think. I went to college for music. I studied music diligently for a quarter century, but then I stopped. And I was more than willing to forget as much as I could. I wanted to love music. I loved performing. But studying music made me stop loving music. In the years I spent listening to Al teach me about the finer points of music, I never bothered to mention the words Bachelor of Fine Arts in Vocal Performance. What I pursued in my past was none of his business and none of his interest. He wasn't capable of believing I ever had ambition. In the water, I'm wondering if Al might be right about me. What if the only reason I think I'm smarter than him and think he's an idiot is because he's drunk? He's clearly more accomplished than I ever will be. He's, at the very least, probably more ambitious than I am. But I'm training for 3 triathlons while I learn how to swim. I may not be ambitious, but at least I know I have some kind of ambition in me. I could be ambitious if I wanted to be, maybe. Maybe I'm not wasting my potential. Maybe I just prefer the mystery and anticipation of what my potential has in store for the world. You know what a stupid song is? Al asks. I bite my lip to physically restraining myself from saying, everything you've ever played for me? Instead, I just ask, what song is stupid? Meatloaf. Meatloaf isn't a song. Yes, it is. I don't know why it's called Meatloaf. That's stupid to begin with. But then this dumb guy sings, he won't do that, and never tells you what that even is. You know what I think? I think he's gay. I don't know. He might be. But, you know, he tells you exactly what he won't do for love in the song. It's all right there. No, he doesn't. He says, he'll do anything but that. What the fuck is that? And what the fuck does it have to do with meatloaf? I catch the water. I feel it. I feel it. All I had to do was think about being years into sobriety while having a man yell angrily about gay meatloaf. That's how I found my body. I throw the water underneath me with my whole arm. I feel the water break and bend as I pass through it. I move over it. I power through it. I feel my elbow high and my fingers pressing against the firmness of the water beneath me. I have it. This is what it feels like. I flip and squeeze myself taut and begin another lap. Pull out your iPad. Look up the lyrics to this song. I promise you I can show you exactly what he won't do. I know what he won't do. He won't admit he's gay. Yeah, you probably know the song better than I do. You're right. Back in the 90s, I was a young adult racking up tens of thousands of dollars in debt every few months so I could have a career in music one day. Now I'm starting to feel that lack of ambition. Yes, I'm a mile and a half into a swim and I'm hating every moment of it, but I'm determined to complete it. But I'm also realizing that all those years grinding away at a music career and where it led me was being a 41-year-old hooker arguing the merits of the literary composition of Gay Meatloaf's great enigmatic love nocturne and whether that very soft rock anthem is actually titled Meatloaf. I forget about my body. Again. I know my arms don't feel the exhaustion of working hard and correctly. I'm swimming bad. At least I'm swimming.
Hi, welcome to the Triple Existential Podcast with E.B. Cote Nord. I am E.B. Cote Nord, and tonight we are doing our final episode of where we have a guest host. And the way this works is that the House votes with a 2/3 majority to remove me from the podcast.
And then the Senate confirms it with a 50% majority. And the Vice President of the United States appoints a new podcast host after I have been removed from power. And so tonight, Ben from Twitter has been installed as the new leader of our podcast, and I have relinquished all creative control in this peaceful transition of power. Welcome. I mean, I guess I can welcome you to my seat. And now Ben has decided to graciously invite me to be a guest on my former show.
You know, it's I've mentioned it to you, but it's really quite an honor to be here and to be asked by you to be here. It was really feels really very special.
You mean installed by Vice President Kamala Harris?
That feels less special, actually. Really, my first question, in preparation for this, we've had a lot of conversation over the last year, and one of the few nice things about the conversation is that so much of it was text. I could go back and read through all of the very rich conversation we've had this year. So my first question for you is,
are you still enjoying?
Should we maybe tell people how you know me, or we just go on by like you're on Twitter?
Oh, I'm one of your clients. I'm very happy.
This is one of my clients. And so that's why we have a voice distorter going, and we have known each other for several years now. And I think this will be an interesting conversation.
The first question I have for you is just, are you still enjoying asparagus and garlic?
I love asparagus and garlic so much. And I don't get to eat them because, they're not very friendly for in-person work where people are very close to your breath and bodily fluids. But thanks to COVID, nobody's close to my breath or bodily fluids.
So you're enjoying them.
Yes, I love. I actually haven't had asparagus. Sorry, I haven't had asparagus in a while. It's been like a few weeks, so I think I'm due for some asparagus. But it's still like for my entire life, it'll never not be a little unnerving when I have asparagus, because I don't eat it very often, even though I love it. And then I'm always just like, oh my God, what happened? What's going on? Why do I suddenly have, am I, my kidneys about to fall out of my body? What's happening? I'm like, oh yeah, asparagus. Same thing with beets. Is that like an everybody thing? Or is that just like a me thing where like you eat beets and like you get red pee and then you freak out that like your insides are like revolting? And no, just me. Well, I eat beets, and I don't eat beets for work, because it turns my pee red. So I don't want to use that, like, use red pee at work.
Yeah, I can see why that would be. I can see why that would be. onto more serious things. I think one of the things that I have noticed for a long time is just how powerful your writing is. It's and not just for a sex worker, right? It's really powerful writing. It gives people an experience with an emotion, one that perhaps they haven't had, but puts them in that place. I could talk about your writing for hours without actually letting you say anything.
Well, thank you. I mean, I can take off the headphones and let you just go. It's your show, Ben.
But I wanted to point to one particular piece of this, at least as a start. Because I think one of the things, and I think you do this on purpose, but one of the things that you do here is you show yourself experiencing normal emotions, things that are not sex worker related or centered, and it's sort of like you're a real person, you're a regular person, and there's a lot of places where that happens here, but I think the one that struck me is, you're swimming and you're thinking about your kids interrupting you all the time, and My mind can't focus on anything. It's always searching for something to focus on, you know, and I've been interrupted by mom, mom, mom all the time. And I think that describes you as a, you know, as a regular mom who's experiencing, you know, this pandemic. And I think that's powerful.
Well, thank you. I mean, I guess, you know, if I do it on purpose or not, I mean, you know, I'm just kind of talking about myself and my life. So it's not, it's intentional in that I'm intentionally talking about myself and my life. If it seems like jarringly normal, I guess that would be because I'm jarringly normal, you know?
Yeah, I think we talked about this a little bit when your son appeared on the podcast last season, and you were surprised at how strongly so many of us were surprised by it.
I was definitely surprised by your reaction, where you were like, you had said that you were on the fence about even listening to it at all. You were really uncomfortable with the concept of it.
Yeah, I was, and you proved me wrong. Absolutely, 100%. I think that's part of the power, is that you, by like just acting like a regular person living your life, you confront a lot of that bias and just show it for what it is. Like there was no reason not to.
No, there was. I mean, there's. I think that there's definitely a feeling, at least, you know, actually, I don't know what it's like to kind of look at my life from your perspective, because there's definitely like a different sense of intimacy coming from you that's versus like my average listener, who is not somebody who knows me in the same, you know, context that you do. But, you know, feeling like, you know, we do have this understood kind of compartmentalization of our lives, and like what we allow each other to see. And so I can see why that would be especially uncomfortable. I'm actually curious whether it was as uncomfortable for somebody who doesn't, you know me outside of the podcast, or who doesn't know me within the context of, you know, my life as E.B. Cotenord and the Anal Queen of Chicago. So, you know, I wonder if there was like that same level of discomfort, or if it was like, ooh, we get to listen to her kid. And did she really name him Jake from State Farm? Which would have been just really prophetic, because I don't feel like there was a Jake from State Farm when Jake from State Farm was born. So that would have been a really like, oh no, that's just a coincidence, no relation.
Yeah, I that's interesting. I don't know. I do know that I was having a conversation recently with a younger provider who does not yet have kids, but is hoping to one day have kids. And we were talking about how they would raise them with, you know, an awareness of what she is or possibly was doing, and, you know, and how that would be. And when I said, well, I know who you should talk to about that, uh-huh, and mentioned your name, like, immediately they were like, oh, of course that's true. Like, because you're a revolutionary, because you just live your normal life.
it's very strange to think of like my normal life as revolutionary, because it's very normal. I've spent like most of the day wrangling children and rabbits. And I guess most people don't have four rabbits running around their house, but I do. And maybe that's the revolutionary thing.
And two rabbit nations.
I do. I have warring rabbit nations.
That's and it's so funny that we've talked about that, and that's like just so regular life. And I mean, it probably shouldn't be funny, but it is, because there's this expectation that this kind of relationship is more, I don't know what people think this relationship should be like, but But regular stuff isn't a part of it, and it so is.
It really is, and, you know, and but it still is, you know, like I said, it still is compartmentalized. Like, I feel like we have a very intimate, you know, emotional relationship, as well as, you know, obviously there's been a very physical intimacy, but at the same time, there's, you know, I don't feel like I don't know you, like, you know, in this like profoundly intimate way. But yet, like, so many of the details of your everyday life are things that I'm absolutely not privy to. And I don't feel like I'm lacking information on you. Like, they're just not a part of who we are as, you know, friends, or however people want to describe our relationship. I consider it, you know, an intimate friendship, I suppose. I don't know if there's like words in English to describe it, but it's definitely not something that's depicted anywhere that I've ever seen.
Yeah, not much at all. I, you know, every once in a while I see some positive client sex worker depictions, very occasionally, but nothing that really does, you know, really talks about the relationship in any serious fashion. But that actually brings me to another piece of this essay and your essays in general, I think, because from our conversations, I know that you have very positive, very intimate relationships, emotionally intimate relationships with a number of your clients, and that you value that. But my perception is that certainly most, maybe all, but certainly most of the clients that you write about are the ones that the relationship seems not to be working.
I think that there's definitely less interesting things to talk about in a, like, well, you know, we hang out like friends and then we laugh and then I leave. There's no tension in that story. But I've actually been like hitting a writer's block, and that's something that I probably should touch on, because I really do have, you know, a deep and profound love for my clients. And yeah, in this piece, I, you know, I wrote about the aliens guy who is, he really is like one of my favorite people that I know, even if I wouldn't say that like he's my favorite person to deal with. He's just so fascinating. But yeah, I think that, you know, I'm regretting right now that I don't have more conversations about how much I really do care about the people that I see and how much it means to me that I'm able to provide, you know, the experiences that I'm able to provide to them. And I really should write more about that and talk more about that.
Yeah, so I'm going to read to you something you wrote to me. And you can cut it out if you, I don't think you'll. We were talking about the pandemic and about the loneliness and stuff that comes from that. And you said something, you said, I get off Skype calls, check emails, phone calls, I just cry. I just miss being with people. I didn't actually realize how profoundly I care about my work and my clients. I knew I cared, and I knew it was important, but I had no idea how much I would feel like a piece of me was missing without being able to hold you and touch you and be with you. And I know that part of what works is how well you do convey that when you're with someone. So, yeah.
Well, thank you. I actually, you know, I was just thinking before we got on this call, I'm like, I am going to cry so hard when we get off this call, because I don't think I've ever had a conversation, like a voice conversation with you, where I wasn't in the same room with you. And it's been so long, and I do miss my work. I feel, you know, like a part of me has been taken away, and there's been a, I mean, I've been dealing with some pretty serious depression, like in the mourning of the loss of, you know, not just being able to support myself, which is, you know, obviously hugely important to me, because I mean, you don't get into this line of work if being self-sufficient isn't, you know, super important to you on some level. But, you know, just really missing my people, you know, you are so important to me. And I'm really grateful that you and I have been able to manage to figure out this way of having, you know, continuing our relationship in like a different realm and maintaining it, you know, appropriately, where we both keep our boundaries intact. Cause I think I know that's really important to you, and it's obviously very important to me too. So like our boundaries are very much intact, and we've been able to like maintain our connection, but you know, not everybody's been able to do that. And I really, you know, there's people I haven't heard from in almost a year, and I am just like, are they okay? Can I like even Google them? Is that appropriate? Is that not appropriate? Like, I can't reach out and say hello, because that's, you know, part of my job is not to contact them if they don't want to be contacted. And so, you know, if I haven't heard from you, I just want you to know that I'm thinking about you out there in the world.
Wow. I mean, I think we've talked a little bit about how social media, but even before the pandemic, you know, changed the dynamic and the relationship between providers and clients. And the pandemic certainly has, you know, added to that, you know, piled it on higher and deeper. So, I mean, have you found yourself finding new clients as a result of the pandemic that are, you know, virtual only, people that you're forming relationships with, you know, without the physical touch?
I've picked up some virtual clients. I think the biggest thing that's happened thanks to social media is that people that would not have reached out otherwise, because they were waiting until they were traveling to Chicago and they're, you know, remote, or, you know, they were, I mean, that's really the big one, is that people who aren't local have reached out and been like, oh, well, we should have these virtual sessions that nobody thought about before. But it's still pretty, it's pretty quiet. It's pretty quiet over here. I don't think that I'm a very good virtual provider. I do my best, and I know that there's at least, you know, I mean, there's clients that have definitely benefited from our ability to connect virtually, but you know, I feel like, you know, where I really shine is in person. And I feel like that's where I bring the best version of myself. I don't know. How do you feel like I'm doing online?
So, you know, I think we actually talked about this a while back about how, you know, people who are looking for in-person providers are generally not satisfied with, you know, the virtual. And so, like, you know, one of the things that we talked about is that, you know, we talk a lot online, but our talk is really very PG. I mean, there's really very little that we've talked about that, you know, we couldn't share very broadly without any worry. For myself, I know that, you know, and we've talked about this, what I'm looking for as a client, even though it's certainly sexual in nature, but it's really about, you know, emotional intimacy and closeness. And that happens online differently. And so I think you do really well at maintaining that relationship that we have. I mean, like I said, we've talked a lot and in very, like some very rich conversation over the course of this past year that have happened text, you know, in text. And, you know, so you do really well at maintaining that relationship. It's not providing, I mean, you know, it's not providing all of the things that I need or that I want, but that couldn't happen virtually with anybody. Like that's not on the table. So, but it does mean that, you know, when we're all vaccinated and, you know, things calm down, you know, there's a certain place that both of us will be for a while. And, you know, we may not talk much.
Well, you know, I mean, I know that, you know, for you both, I mean, I don't like to separate like the sexual from the non-sexual elements of the relationship. Because I mean, the relationship is, I mean, it's a sexual relationship. Like there's right. there's no question about that. And that, you know, the intellectual and emotional connection is something that is inherently a part of the sexual experience that we have together. And if I wasn't able to provide that, or if you weren't able to provide that, or if we didn't have that connection, like the physical part wouldn't happen. So I would say that, you know, the physical is more than like, so I think the entire thing is sexual, but there's the physical element and the mental emotional element, but which is just kind of nuanced and nerdy and pedantic maybe, but I think it's really important that people don't, you know, view sex as being like the sex is the part where we stick things in the holes, because I think sex is a holistic experience. And I think it's actually in a lot of ways really wholesome, because, you know, like I said, or like you said, we've had all of these really, really wholesome conversations over the past year. But to pretend that that's not all leading up to this like grand finale of us getting in a room together is naive.
I agree with you. I think I mean, for me, I think that at least I think for me that part of this is that sex is a very, the physical relationship is a very real part of intimacy in my, and I, you know, I don't know if that's something that is normal or not, but that's, you know, that's where I am. So yeah, and I think that's part of why I was wondering if you had new clients, because you know, we have this relationship that's ongoing that has something before it and something, you know, and something that's leading up to. So the conversations, you know, are in that context.
Yeah, I feel like, you know, I offer Skype calls for clients to have sessions, mm-hmm. and it is really hard to fill 20-30 minutes of a Skype call with just the physical part. Nobody is sitting there for 20 minutes, 30 minutes. Like that is not, so there's a lot of chatting and connecting, but it's not the same. I don't think, I mean, the physical isn't the same, but also the social emotional connection isn't the same. And I think everybody knows it's a proxy, and I feel it like it feels like a proxy.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think we're all desperate for, I mean,
You have no idea.
No, I mean, I think I shared with you, I mean, the truth is my life right now is so normal adjacent. It's like whatever, it's a whole different thing. But you know, I remember when we were closed up, and like I think I told you that like I would like close my eyes and touch myself like on my shoulder, you know, and pretend it was somebody else, because like I was so desperate for physical touch.
You know, I had a request for a custom video of just, you know, my face, like my mouth, like somebody's just like, I just want to like, I want to think about kissing somebody. I want to think about just being face to face with somebody. Like, that's such an intense fantasy right now, because we're so, even when we see each other's faces, we don't see our entire faces. And it's like, so we're even isolated when we're together, because we're still not face to face. We're 6 feet apart and we're eyes only. And it's sad. It's really sad. And to say that we are, it's depressing in the way that, not like, oh, it's saddening, but like, it actually is causing people to sink into depressions. And I'm not excluded from that. I'm definitely feeling that, like, I miss, physically engaging with other people.
Right. Yeah. I'm gonna try and uplift the conversation a little bit, make it a little cheerier, maybe. It's interesting to me that a lot of this is interesting to me, because I find that, I see different providers and I have different relationships with them, and even pre-pandemic, and the
intellect. But I'm the best, right? I'm the best. Like, I just want that on the record.
You are absolutely the
best. And so is everybody else, though. So.
One of the ways that you're different, and I've shared this with you, at least for me, and I'm sort of curious about, because this is clearly not true with all of your clients, because of the essays that I've read, like, you're one of the ones who is least likely to let me get away with something, saying something ridiculous. Like, you're the one most likely to challenge my preconceptions and to force me to say it better and think it better. And so, like, the intellectual part of our relationship is front and center. It was front and center even pre-pandemic, and it's certainly sexual. I don't mean to deny that in any way, shape, or form. Right. But the form of that sexual, it's not just this physical thing. There's a conversation, and probably the conversation is fraught because of the sexual. Like, I care about your approval because of that sexual relationship, but I find it interesting that you can't. I can't imagine you listening to you. I can't imagine you listening to someone talk about meatloaf and be like, "Yeah, okay, you must know it better than I do." Like, I can't imagine those words coming out of your mouth. Like, when clearly he's so obviously wrong.
Yeah, I think that there's like years of frustration with, aliens that has led me to like just be like, this isn't energy that's worth spending right now. And but, if I know that somebody's capable of doing better and being better, I don't have a lot of patience for them not being better. And I guess, like, for some people, like, I don't expect them to be better. So if you want to tell me that, gay meatloaf is the name of the song, then that we'll never know what he won't do for love, then, if that's the most that I can get from you, like, I can't push you to be better than that. But I feel like our relationship was actually kind of, it had that tension before we even met in person. And, I was pushing you, and you would ask questions, and you would come back, and you're like, I want to be better. I want to do better. I'm listening. What can I do to be better? And I don't think everyone wants to be challenged. I mean, I know not everybody wants to be challenged that way. So I know that you do. And or maybe you don't want to. You don't always like it, I'm sure. it's probably incredibly unpleasant, but once you get it, you're glad you did, and you want more, I think. And I have such a deep appreciation for people that have allowed people like me to change their points of view about the world. And I know that you know, I'm not the only provider that you've met who's really challenged your preconceived notions. And that's something that, I absolutely adore about you. And it makes me just genuinely admire you, because I think it's a really wonderful trait of yours. And I wish more people were like that instead of just being like gay meatloaf. But you know, there's a place in the world for gay meatloaf too. So
I guess that really brings me to another this question. So among teachers that think of themselves as called to teaching, everybody who went to school had teachers who were bad teachers and mediocre teachers, and then there are the teachers who clearly were, this was their purpose in life. And so among those teachers, we talk a lot about, what are certain traits that are the things that, good teachers, great teachers have in common, and what are the things that make teaching a calling? I'm wondering if you think about that and talk about that with your provider friends. Like, there are some of you who are really great at what you do. You provide a sense of intimacy and care and being cared for and being loved. And sometimes that means, like we were just talking, sometimes that means, really challenging the person to grow and helping them do that. And sometimes it means, letting them be who they are. And you bring to it a tremendous amount of insight about the person and about people. I'm wondering if you guys talk about this and what traits you see as being, sort of the fundamental parts of being a talented provider.
This is like trade secret. No, we don't talk about it like that. We really don't. It's, my experience is a lot more, we get together. There's a lot of things that are incredibly frustrating about what we do and about the people that we deal with. And that is something that we talk about more. And I feel like we're very protective of kind of the more intimate parts of our relationships with our clients. If we can talk about who we appreciate and why we appreciate them, but really getting into like the vulnerability and the nitty-gritty of that vulnerability is something that we're all very guarded about in person. So I wouldn't, I wouldn't say that we have conversations about like whether this is our calling or not. We do on Twitter, which is sort of this interesting way that we have a conversation about this thing that we're very guarded about in a very public way. That's sort of like, I can say it, but I can say it with my eyes closed. So it's like nobody's watching. Well, I say it to the whole world, which I wouldn't say to five other providers in a room. So I don't know what makes other people feel called. And I don't know that I feel called to sex work. I feel called to people, and I feel called to mattering to people. And I feel, called to want to be a part of people's lives in an important way. And this is how I ended up there. And in a life before my life as a sex worker, I was a writer who, felt this need to really speak to the world about important things. So I feel like that's more my calling than sex work. I just happened to have fallen here, and really all of the other $600 an hour jobs where I get to do that, you know, part time, are just not hiring. So this is where I'm at. And also I get to have threesomes. So there's that.
Yeah, which I mean, I think that speaks to one piece of it, which is that as a group, certainly you and certainly the other providers I know as a group have far fewer hang-ups about sex, are far more sex positive than the culture that most of you grew up in, I think. I don't know how that happened. Like, I don't know how, you know, I mean, I think that might be an individual story for each of you, but it seems like as a group, you are far less into various hang-ups about sex than, you know, the other mother who's also swimming laps in that pool with you.
Oh, yeah, I don't. Oh, I think I've told you this story. So I have a work bag that I take to work. I also sometimes take this bag to the gym, and it has, so there's We Are Dancers USA, and they have, you know, pins and various like funny things, but they have this pin that says, anal sex, not just for your parents anymore. And I have that on my work/gym bag, 'cause when I go to the gym, it just goes right into a locker. One day my kid was going to swim class and couldn't find their bag. And so I was like, here, just take my bag, you know, throw a towel in it, throw, you know, whatever you need to go to swimming. Here's your stuff. Just take the bag. And then like they go into swim class, they drop it next to the pool, which is at my gym, which is, you know, where the other moms at the pool are. You know, they drop the bag with the other kids' bags. And then I come in at the end of class to pick up my kid and talk to the teacher and kind of like, you know, talk about what's going on and whether we're like moving up to the next level. And my kid just like picks up their bag and he just keeps like eyeing it out of like looking down out of the corner of his eye and like looking at the bag and like looking at me and just like trying, like you can see he's like trying to focus on what I'm saying, but he's clearly distracted, but he's still like looking at me and his eyes just keep wandering out of the bag. And I'm just like, what is this guy's problem? And we're walking out and I'm walking behind my child who was 9 at the time. And there is this pin on my child's bag that says anal sex, not just for your parents anymore. And I was like, well, now I'm going to find a gym in another town, in another country, on another planet. And I am never, ever going back anywhere on the face of the earth to do anything. So, yeah, now my child checks the bags before we do it. And actually, like, if I put the pin back on my bag, like, they remove it and, like, put it in a drawer. So, so yeah, I guess I am more open-minded than most of the other moms at the pool. To answer your question. But no, I mean, you know, I think that there's, you know, being exposed to a lot of, you know, working in the adult industry and working in sex as a job, a lot of the mystery and mystique and like the hangups sort of have to go away because you're like, this isn't a big deal. And you realize how many people are into this stuff that people think are weird. And then you also start to wonder, why does everyone think this is weird? Because, like, everyone is super into this. Like, there's a huge stigma against golden showers. And let's be real, everyone is, okay, not everyone, but, like, it's, when men are alone with women, they are not as hung up about golden showers as they pretend to be when they're not alone with women. And that's, like, pretty across the board. So, like, so many guys like to be peed on. I don't even consider it a fetish. Like, it's basically vanilla. It's so common. So I think that really sort of seeing how the sausage is made, so to speak, kind of changes the way that you get to have hang-ups about sex.
I mean, do you feel like you walked into this work with fewer hang-ups than the people around you, or or it really developed while you were doing this work?
I never had a lot of hang-ups about sex, really. I think I felt like I was supposed to, but I never really understood why I was supposed to. And so getting into it didn't feel like I was, you know, doing something that was like super against who I was or challenging, you know, my preconceived thoughts. It's like, well, you know, it's sex. And I think that I have a much deeper appreciation for it now, but it's definitely changed my entire relationship with sex. And I don't think that it's the same as what, you know, civilians have or even what clients have with sex. It's changed that entirely. And I, you know, that would be like a whole other show that I could get into all of that. Cause it's, you know, I don't have a standard relationship with sex anymore in, you know, in my social life even, but I don't think that I had a typical sort of shame about it to begin with. You know, I was like, why is it a big deal to sleep with somebody I don't know? Like that just like, so we're going to have fun. Okay. That seems fine. You know, whereas other people are like, but you don't know them. Like, okay. And I don't need to. Like, but you don't even like them. Like, well, I can for like a half an hour. Right.
Yeah. That's an interesting point. I think that's one of the things that I think that is pretty interesting to me too, about is that you can for a half an hour. Like, I don't think I could.
Oh, well, first of all, I think that anybody that you hate, like, is fascinating enough to spend an hour with, you know, or more, and in like a sexual way, especially because like you can like hate fucking is weirdly hot. So there's that. But but you know, I think that it's really true that every single person on the face of the earth has something worthy of loving and something interesting about them and something that is likable and lovable about them that can be tapped into, if only for an hour, but can be tapped into for an hour, and you can appreciate them for that time. And not everybody wants me to do that either. Like, some people are just like, I don't need you to like me. I don't need you to appreciate. I don't even need you to think of me as like a human being. I just need you to do what you need to do and go home. And I can do that too. That's, you know, I'm there to provide the experience that they want and they need. So there's also that. And you know, that's not really, I think people think that that would be depressing and difficult to be depersonalized like that, and like kind and like that's dehumanizing. But I don't know that in that moment it is. I think there's a lot of stigmas about it that are dehumanizing. But to just somebody doesn't need to be spending a lot of emotional energy on sex. They just need to have sex. Like I can give that to them, and that's not a big deal.
I mean, it's interesting to me. I think the piece of that I find, I mean, I think I would find that dehumanizing, but I don't think that that's more dehumanizing than lots of other jobs. And I mean, I think that's where it gets interesting, is that, you know, somehow, you know, it's bad to do this in a sexual context, you know, as sex work, to be in a situation where, you know, you're just there to do something, you know, to, without really anybody engaging with you as a human being. And like, it's bad there, but like, you know, when you're operating a sewing machine and, you know, like all of a sudden that's fine. That's, you know, that's somehow, you know, a good thing to do.
You don't even have to be on the same part of the world, but I mean, nobody asks their pizza delivery guy, like, how do you feel about people who like don't even care about you as a person? Like, they're just hungry and they just want a pizza, and they're just going to give you money and you give them the pizza and then you go home. Like, that's what the pizza guy does.
Right.
Like, that's his job. He gives you a pizza and he goes home, and his job is like not to be there like, how do you feel about the pizza? Like, do you think that we're going to have a long-term relationship around pizza? Are you going to call me again? Like, And then the person getting the pizza isn't like, do you care about whether I'm hungry or not? Like, do you care about my needs, or are you just here because I'm paying you for pizza? Like, well, he's just here because you're paying him for pizza. And, you know, we all understand that. And I don't think there's anything wrong with him bringing you the pizza that you paid him to bring you.
I mean, it's funny because
we've all seen porn where the guy gets invited in, and now we're just like making it weird.
But no, I was but I was actually thinking like I think really in the perfect world, like in a place where people are properly valued, I don't know that we'd have that long conversation that you suggested, but you know, to acknowledge the person as a human being when he delivers the pizza, like, hi, how are you, thank you, I think those things would be appropriate. And then I think the experience of pizza worker would be less dehumanizing in that scenario. And, you know, and the boss, you know, would appreciate, you know, his driving in the snow and, you know, and say something to him about that. I mean, I think there's a lot of human interaction around pizza delivery that could make it less dehumanizing than it probably often is.
Yeah, I mean, I would say that pizza delivery is probably, like, incredibly analogous to sex work in a lot of ways.
But I think your point is, you know, but even in our world where all of that is not the case, you know, we don't think it's a bad job, you know, for the person who needs that job. Like, it's a job. It's a good job. It's a fine, you know, like, doesn't pay particularly well, but it's a fine job. It's, you know, there's no stigma attached to that job in the way that there is here. And we pretend that the reason is because it's dehumanizing, even though, right, these other things are just as dehumanizing. But somehow you attach sex to it and it gets all different.
It does get all different. And, you know, it's our bodies, and like, as if everybody doesn't bring their bodies to work every day. But we should probably wrap this up because we are at almost 50 minutes of recording.
Okay, so 1 second. Let me just see if there's...
Okay.
Yeah, I was going to ask you. Yeah, no, that's fine.
No, why don't you just ask me and we'll figure it out. Or maybe we just have a real long episode. Ask me.
Well, I was going to sort of, the one last thing that I noticed in some of the notes that I'd taken was, and this is connected to, so I'm backing, let me back up a step. In the midst of all this, you talked about how you could like someone for an hour, for a half hour, whatever it is. And while intellectually I'm with you on that, I recognize that human beings all have worth. I don't think I could do that. But I think that the one of the things that this is actually related to in a weird sort of way is the way that you value other people's love languages and can see their expression of their care for you, however they choose to do it. And, you know, and some of those things speak to you in different ways. You know, we've talked about how, you know, getting a pair of really nice shoes from someone means something to you because you see them as fashion and art and a beautiful expression, but also, you know, the gift giving as, you know, their love language. But I think that your ability to see and understand people's love languages and the different ones, whatever your love language might be, is really connected to all of this, that you can see the good in all of those different people.
Well, thank you. Somebody's love language is their love language, and somebody giving me a pair of, you know, Louboutins is, you know, I do have someone who that, like, gift giving is his love language, and he's a really great gift giver. And, you know, I feel like yours is, you know, is somewhere like between like gift giving and like acts of service, but like I'd say that really more acts of service. But you really like to do things for people to make them feel special. And Like, I love, you're such a grand gestures person. I love it. It's so interesting and unique in the way that you do it. So anyway, but yeah, I do have, you know, a Louboutin guy who is definitely listening to this, but he's, it brings him so much joy to give, to like give. It's, and it's something that he's able to do. And I, you know, and it's like, yeah, I appreciate getting shoes because they're really nice shoes, but just to be somebody that somebody cares about enough to do that for and to express their feelings for you in this way that makes them feel important and makes them feel valued and honored. You know, I, how do I not, how do you not appreciate that?
Well, I think that, I think that's a really wonderful note to end on, because I was thinking about how you're asking me to do this, and all of the conversation around that made me feel tremendously cared for and honored and valued. And this has been a tremendous thrill and honor to have this conversation with you that I know you're going to share with lots of people. And so I want to thank you again for asking me to do this.
Thank you so much for doing it. It means a lot for you to come on and be vulnerable like this and be willing to share, you know, your relationship with me in this very public way. So I there's so much admiration for what it takes to be able to, and able and willing to do that. So I really appreciate that.
I am moved beyond words. That's really the So have a wonderful evening.
Okay, thank you. You too.